This is KJZZ, your news and information station in Phoenix and across Arizona. I'm Tiara Vian. Here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. And this is the podcast that's designed to catch you up on some highlights from around the region. So thanks for listening. Here are a few of the stories for the week of April 6th, 2026. Arizona's outdoor workers face some of the hottest conditions in the country, and these workers are heading into another summer without any specific state regulations requiring their employers to provide them with water, shade, or breaks from the heat. In the first of a three-part series on workplace heat safety this week, Catherine Davis Young explains what some workers want to see change.
Jesus Reyes has been a day laborer in Tucson for about 30 years. He mostly does landscaping work, so he's spent a lot of time under the scorching Arizona sun. But one afternoon in June 2021, the heat really caught up with him.
It started with a severe headache, a lot of vomiting, and a lot of dizziness.
He'd been working all day in triple-digit temperatures without much access to water or shade. By the time he got home, he knew it was an emergency. His wife took him to the hospital. By the time they got there, he'd lost consciousness.
The doctor told me that I had arrived just in time.
It was heat stroke, a life-threatening condition that affects the heart, brain, and other vital organs. Reyes needed two surgeries to save his life.
It wasn't an easy thing.
5 years later, he still doesn't feel like he's fully recovered.
I don't want to push my body too hard because I'm afraid. Afraid that the same thing might happen to me again, because it was a truly terrible experience.
OSHA estimates tens of thousands of workers like Reyes suffer illnesses or injuries related to heat exposure on the job nationwide each year, and estimates hundreds die. It's unclear exactly how many Arizona workers have died from working in the heat, but KJZZ found dozens of examples of fatalities going back decades. Just last summer, a Phoenix area postal worker died delivering mail on a 106-degree day, a young construction worker died from heat on a job site in Glendale, and an air conditioning technician died in a hot attic near Prescott. And these cases appear to be on the rise.
We see more people reporting those issues.
Emma Torres is executive director of Campesinos Sin Fronteras, a Yuma-based organization that advocates for farm workers.
For years and years, people had been exposed to heat and they had found ways to, protect themselves, wearing a big hat or, drinking water all the time. But what they're reporting is that more and more, it's worse.
Arizona has never had state regulations specifically to protect workers from heat. And as climate change drives more intense heat waves, outdoor worker deaths in Arizona are increasing at a faster rate than in neighboring California, where state regulations for workplace heat safety have been in place since 2005. That's according to a recent study in the journal Health Affairs. Adam Dean is one of the study's authors.
Heat standards can significantly reduce worker deaths if they're well-crafted and well-enforced.
Enforcement, Dean says, is key. Right now, Arizona's Division of Occupational Safety and Health does have a heat emphasis program. ADOSH inspectors look out for heat hazards and provide some training to employers. But labor groups in Arizona have been calling for the state to establish a formal standard under which employers could be cited or fined if they're not providing water, shade, or other specific protections for their workers. They say workers in some of the hottest roles, day laborers, farm workers, have very little job security. Many are immigrants, some may be working without legal status. Torres says if conditions are unsafe, they're highly motivated not to complain.
The most important is that they come here to work. They don't want to cause any problems, any issues. So more likely, they would just not say anything.
Day laborers like Jesus Reyes might work for a different boss every day. He says those bosses have all the power.
We're day laborers. We work 8 hours, and most of our bosses drive us like they're cracking the whip over us.
Labor groups say when workers feel intimidated to speak up about hazards, it should be up to the state to enforce safety. Governor Katie Hobbs last year convened a task force to make recommendations to ADOSH around workplace heat rules. Reyes and a few other day laborers testified before an ADOSH advisory committee recently to say they want regulations. But so far, the task force recommendations have fallen short of what labor groups were hoping for. The Industrial Commission of Arizona is expected to begin discussing the recommendations this week, but it appears unlikely they'll establish any new heat rules before summer arrives. For now, Reyes continues working outdoors, but faces a disheartening dilemma.
We have to work to survive.
But in Arizona's heat, he worries whether he'll survive his work. Catherine Davis-Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
This story was produced with support from the Health and Climate Change Reporting Fellowship from USC. Find the entire series at kjzz.org. In politics news, Turning Point USA's political arm spent months pouring money and resources into a little-known utility election in Arizona. The effort contributed to a massive increase in voter turnout, but ultimately failed to stave off a challenge from a slate of clean energy candidates. From the politics desk, Wayne Shutsky reports.
There were 36,000 ballots cast in the board election for Salt River Project's power utility election alone, up from an average of 7,500 votes over the past two elections. Unofficial results show Turning Point candidates Chris Dobson and Barry Paisley will be the next board president and vice president. But the clean energy slate won five seats on the board for SRP's power utility, giving them an 8-6 majority. Board member Sandra Kennedy says they will use that power to push SRP management to adopt more solar and battery storage rather than investing in more natural gas.
I can say that the board members have just kind of been followers of management. So whatever management wanted, they got it. I think it's a new day.
Kennedy lost to Dobson in the board president race, but still holds a seat on the board. Turning Point characterized that as a major victory. Wayne Shutsky, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening.
Rio Salado College is hosting a community conversation on the future of affordable housing. Join industry leaders, innovators, and local voices to explore new ideas shaping housing in our region. The event is Thursday, April 30th. Learn more at riosalado.edu/futurehousing.
In business news, Phoenix's iconic Mystery Castle has a new owner. Catherine Davis-Young has more on what's in store for the once-threatened landmark.
The 1930s stone castle near South Mountain Park has been closed to the public since 2022 and had been set for demolition. But the Arizona Preservation Foundation now reports the property has been sold. The Harrell family of companies, which bought the site, has been involved in other historical preservation projects throughout Arizona. The new owner plans to preserve the Mystery Castle and turn it into a destination event venue, according to the Preservation Foundation. A community forum to discuss the castle's future is set for May 2nd. Catherine Davis-Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In tribal natural resources, Tuesday marks the deadline to comment on a Trump administration proposal that could roll back a two-decade ban on oil and gas drilling around a UNESCO World Heritage site. Gabriel Pietrazio has more on potential changes for public lands surrounding Chaco Canyon.
The Bureau of Land Management wants to repeal a Biden-era 10-mile buffer zone of more than 336,000 acres, rich in oil and gas. Some 40,000 wells already dot the greater Chaco landscape.
What we are fighting for is the last, right now, unleased federal lands.
Marissa Narajo is from the Santa Clara Pueblo. She's with the New Mexico nonprofit Sovereign Energy.
Even when tribes lead, engage, and help shape the process over many years, you know, at this point, there's no guarantee that those outcomes will be respected, as we're seeing by the 7-day public comment.
The mineral leasing withdrawal in 2023 followed a 150-day comment period. Gabriel Pietrazio, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In water news, the latest forecasts for water in the Colorado River show a grim picture. As Alex Hager reports, low snowpack across the Rocky Mountains will lead to a tense summer for water managers in Arizona.
Incredibly low, seriously dry, depressing. Those are just some of the words tossed around by scientists in the latest briefing on drought conditions. Nels Bjarke is a scientist with the Western Water Assessment. He says hot and dry conditions stacked up all winter.
There is possibility that we could experience the driest or historical low flows on record. The notion that a wet kind of April, May, June might save us is quickly leaving the building.
That shortage could send major reservoirs like Lake Powell plummeting to record lows, adding pressure to already tense negotiations about how to share water. If state leaders can't agree, the federal government could force major cutbacks on the supply that flows to Arizona. Alex Hager, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. In Fronteras News, this week, Tucson leaders heard the results of a months-long study of what residents want to see out of a proposed city amendment to regulate data centers. From the Fronteras desk in Tucson, Elisa Resnick has more.
Last year, Mayor Regino Romero and the city council set out to draft formal limits on how data centers can function within the city. That, after water needs for a data center proposal called Project Blue, generated intense public backlash. City leaders were briefed on the findings of a series of public meetings about the amendment this week. Vice Mayor Lane Santa Cruz asked how feasible it would be to ban data centers outright.
It's going to be a major strain on our water and energy infrastructure. And in the desert city, that's just a trade-off, especially in this time that we can't afford.
City leaders said a moratorium on data centers would have to be legally defensible and would likely be limited to 120 days. After that, property owners could file suit. Elisa Resnick, KJZZ News, Tucson.
And finally, from KJZZ's The Show, a conversation about southern Arizona's sky islands and habitat danger for migrating birds. Here's co-host Lauren Gilger.
If you've ever traveled to the far southern reaches of our fair state, near Patagonia on the Mexico border, you know you'll find a region that looks different than the dry, rocky, saguaro-laden desert we live in here in the valley. There are grassy fields, tree-covered mountains, desert scrub, riparian preserves. In fact, it's one of the top biodiversity hotspots in the world, especially for birders.
On our preserve, on the Patagonia Sonoita Creek Preserve, we have over 270 different bird species that have been documented here.
Wow.
And part of the reason for that is we sit right in the middle of a number of flyways for migrating birds.
That's Aaron Morotek, Patagonia Sonoita Creek Preserve Manager for the Nature Conservancy. He told me the region turns out to be pretty perfect for birds on their migrations north for the summer or south for the winter. Think of it as a sort of rest stop for them along the way. But those all-important rest stops are in danger now as climate change threatens these delicate ecosystems. I spoke with Morotek more about it, beginning with why this region is so perfect for migratory birds.
We sit in an area called the Madrean Sky Island ecosystem through here. So we're sitting like in this kind of Sonoran Desert ecoregion, but within that ecoregion, we have all of these mountain ranges that pop up. And of course, that's giving you different elevation gradients that give rise to different habitat types. So because of the very differentiated habitat types that we have through here, it allows for various bird species that rely on those very specific habitat types to all find their individual ecological niches to be able to thrive and move through this area and continue on in their life cycles.
That's amazing. So this kind of idea of a stopover, like a rest stop for birds as they're migrating and the reasons they're drawn, these are really important for birds and for those migration patterns, right? Like if they don't have those rest stops, it can be a problem.
Absolutely. That's spot on. You know, in particular in this area that we sit in, we're at about 4,000 feet of elevation here in Patagonia. And so we are right in the middle of that transition zone between kind of that lower Sonoran Desert ecoregion, which is generally characterized by, you know, our iconic saguaro cacti. But then we're like up above us in these mountain ranges, we have Douglas fir forest, ponderosa pines, mixed oak woodland chaparral zones.
Yeah.
But I think one of the really big distinguishing features about our area is that we have a perennial stream that runs right through the middle of it, and that's Sonoita Creek. Mm. So Sonoita Creek runs approximately 12 miles, and there's surface water throughout that entire 12 miles there. And, you know, in the desert, water is life. It's not just life for people. It's also life for birds and mammals and reptiles. And so really that surface water availability really creates a profoundly important habitat through here for those animals that are migrating to be able to access that water for their stopovers.
Okay, so tell us some of the species that come through. I know you're not like an extreme birder here, but that you enjoy or that folks are really there for. Are there really outstanding highlights that people come to see every year?
Yeah, well, while I'm not an extreme birder, I do associate and I'm around extreme birders all the time. So I can fortunately name a couple for you here. You
Okay.
know, there's a number of different warbler species that are really iconic in this area for migrating species coming through here. For instance, Lucy's warblers, those just showed up here on the preserve, and they really tend to enjoy our mesquite bosquet habitat type through this preserve through here. But one of my favorite birds that migrates here every summer is the greyhawk. Okay. And
Whoa.
greyhawks have
Yeah.
greyhawks have very specific habitat requirements. They really like riparian zones with field habitats adjacent to those riparian zones. And that really characterizes the Patagonia Sonoita Creek Preserve, which I'm sitting at here right now. We have that riparian ecosystem moving through here with these big grassland fields that surround it. So it's really the perfect habitat type for these greyhawks. And greyhawks, you know, they're more commonly found through much of Sonora, Mexico, and down south of that as well. But their northernmost range is right around here in southern Arizona. And so as a migrating species, to be able to see that species that you would most commonly see in Mexico coming up into the United States, I think that really makes it super, super unique. And people, again, travel from all over the world to come to this area of the world to be able to view that greyhawk, to enjoy it in its natural habitat.
Yeah, that's amazing, Greyhawk. So, I mean, these kind of rest stops, these stopovers for these migratory birds, though, are becoming harder to find, it sounds like, especially when it comes to those incredibly specific ones they can be, like for the Greyhawk you mentioned. I mean, what happens when one of these rest stops disappears? Are we seeing this happen in southern Arizona?
Oh, absolutely. You know, in southern Arizona, we're seeing a long-term trend of drier winters and reduced monsoonal precipitation. And we're also combining that with increased water consumption in the state of Arizona by a growing human population. And that's causing many of our once perennial streams to start to run dry, resulting in the loss of not only the valuable aquatic habitat, but maybe more importantly, for a lot of these migrating birds, the associated riparian habitat that would be found alongside of these stream ecosystems.
Yeah.
And as I mentioned, water in the desert is life, but it is also our greatest limiting resources. And climate models suggest that Arizona may continue to see reduced precipitation annually throughout our entire state. And so we're seeing that reduced precipitation. We're seeing warmer daytime and nighttime temperatures, which are stressing these natural ecosystems and creating optimal conditions for things like wildfires or pest insects or diseases or invasive species to come into these areas that were once really, really important stopovers and still continue to be. But we're seeing those stresses start to result in ecosystem conversion, where vegetative communities are slowly being replaced by species that are suited to a warmer and drier climate. And ultimately, these conversions can result in habitat shifts, leading to the replacement of entire wildlife communities, which is really concerning for the long-term sustainability of these migration stopovers throughout the entire state of Arizona.
Yeah. So let me ask you lastly, Aaron, like the question, I guess, that drives this home for folks, because I know we talk a lot about water scarcity. We talk a lot about climate change and warming weather. And I think a lot of folks will say, you know, we can't worry about things like migratory birds when we have to worry about, you know, human beings having these kind of resources going forward. But there are, when it comes to these species, broader ecological questions at hand, it sounds like.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think I tend not to be focused on single species. I tend to think of our ecosystems as really, really complex processes. Really, what we're starting to see is an upset in the balance of these really, really complex systems that we call ecosystems down here. And fortunately, there are a number of solutions.
Okay,
Some of
yeah.
those solutions might look like conserving a variety of habitats. We're looking at restoring and maintaining those diverse habitats to support broad species assemblages. And really, what we also seek to do is implement long-term monitoring protocols for vulnerable species, in particular migrating vulnerable species and their associated habitats, to inform adaptive management. So these are some of the things that we can think about doing to preserve these really, really important flyovers or stopovers for migrating species across our entire state of Arizona.
Okay. Well, glad it's not hopeless, it sounds like. All right. We'll leave it there. That is Aaron Morotek, Patagonia Sonoita Creek Preserve Manager for the Nature Conservancy, joining us to talk about stopovers for migratory birds. Aaron, thank you very much for coming on the show. I really appreciate you being here.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you so much.
And this has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by the Katina Foundation and Basis Charter Schools, Palo Verde Generating Station, SRP, and the Virginia G. Piper Charitable Trust. Thank you for listening and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian. This is KJZZ. Listen more, learn more online and on the KJZZ mobile app.